This is the Paula Gordon Show. We're delighted that Dr. Barry Beatty is with Bill Russell and me. I am Paula. We're talking about a great mystery, a search, a hunt, a puzzle, and you found where these mosquitoes were in the course of the winter. Isn't that sort of the story of science? I want to hear the end of the particular, but isn't this a really good metaphor for what happens when you're studying big questions in science?
Well, I think it is. It, you know, obviously a lot of resources were focused on this. We had no understanding of how this virus was maintained during the winter. And luckily, one of the students, Samsak, decided to look at mosquito larvae that were emerging in these tree holes the next year, and he was able to isolate virus from these larvae.
How come they didn't freeze?
Well, they actually overwinter in the egg stage, and these mosquitoes go into, or the embryos, once the eggs are laid, they're induced into a state called diapause. So they're resistant to freezing and thawing, and they're maintained throughout the winter. And then when the temperature conditions and photoperiod are correct, the larvae emerge, and in this case, if that mother mosquito had been infected, the eggs are infected, and so the cycle can start anew. But as I said previously, there was absolutely no precedent for this, so it was quite a remarkable discovery. Subsequently, this virus has been recognized as a major cause of pediatric encephalitis throughout the upper Midwest, indeed down into even the Carolinas and so forth. But it was a remarkable discovery, and it certainly excited me about working more with arthropods. You know, here's a virus that causes severe encephalitis in the vertebrate host, the tangential vertebrate host, the human. Virus relatives to this are major causes of abortion and teratology in parts of the world. But yet this virus...
Teratology?
Malformations and stuff. Mm-hmm. But yet this virus went through the embryo stage, through the egg stage, embryogenesis, and very efficiently maintained in this vector. You know, it's the perfect way for a virus to survive a Wisconsin winter.
So actually, clever little devil.
They are clever. It gets more clever than you can possibly imagine. We've been looking at the molecular basis of this recently, and we've got some good indications that the virus is perturbing the ability of the mosquito cells to kill themselves. It's manipulating the apoptosis regulation system.
I don't know what that means.
Many cells have the ability to kill themselves, program cell death. And many cells that are infected with viruses actually kill themselves. It's sort of a neighborhood watch thing where they protect the rest of the organism once a virus is in there.
Huh.
But anyway, this is certainly remarkable. You know, you sort of continue your PhD research throughout your life, and so this has been a side effort of mine for many years. And
you said an interesting thing in talking about this, that you had to overcome the established dogma.
Yeah.
Which I would think, you know, we sort of get it in our heads that there's this, you know, just sort of steady step-after-step advance of science moving boldly forward in many different directions. But there's some counterforces in there, other
sure.
than the obduracy of nature.
In addition to the obduracy of nature.
And that is the obduracy of one manifestation of nature, which is humans, specifically scientists. But isn't that, you know, part of the challenge that you and your colleagues have to deal with?
Well, it certainly is. And in this case, most of the seminal work, so to speak, with arboviruses and mosquito vectors had been done with viruses, arboviruses from other families, from alpha virus. For example, alpha viruses and flaviviruses. And much work had gone into how viruses, important virus diseases like St. Louis encephalitis and Eastern equine encephalitis and Western equine encephalitis are maintained during temperate seasons. And point of fact is we still don't know. These are major human and animal pathogens, and we still don't know how these diseases in the United States are maintained during the winter season. As part of that research, these very famous scientists done elegant research and had demonstrated that vertical transmission wasn't occurring in these other mosquito virus cycles. So you can imagine if you're a young investigator or investigator trying to do a new, to take a new pass, so to speak, you submit a grant on that, obviously everybody's going to say, well,
haven't
Dr.
you read?
So-and-so.
Haven't you read these?
Exactly, exactly. And so, you know, maybe it was... simply good fortune, but...
Well, luck does play in science, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And I think in this case, as I told you, this very good Thai scientist perhaps wasn't so attuned to the U.S. dogma, and so took that step.
He didn't understand the tenure track, did he?
Well,
that's a fascinating look, though. If you've got somebody who knows a lot but doesn't know, doesn't have the isn't marching in step, just a little bit out of step, can open up a whole new direction.
Well, and at that time too, there had been an enormous amount of work on how this virus was maintained, and these labs, principally again at the University of Wisconsin, Dr. Thompson and Yule and DeFoliard, et cetera, had looked at almost every other possibility. So it was slowly being narrowed down to this event. And it turns out that this is was the first mosquito-borne virus that we really understood how it was maintained in the winter, and opened up a lot of other research on other virus-pathogen interactions and so forth.
You are particularly focused these days on dengue.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that dengue was a big threat in the world at large, because I don't think about these things. Dengue is one of those, and if I understand correctly, that may be the most threatening pathogen in the big world at the moment, certainly among them. And that is spelled D-E-N-G-U-E. I had never actually heard it pronounced before.
Yeah.
Shouldn't I know about these things?
Well, dengue dengue hemorrhagic fever shock syndrome certainly are major, major public health problems. Dengue has been recognized for a long time, historically recognized. It was around the world, et cetera. And its close relative, yellow fever, was obviously a major public health problem throughout much of our history. I mean, yellow fever used to just decimate the populations of port cities, et cetera, in the New World. And the probably the reason you haven't heard much about it is that in the Americas in the 50s and 60s, there were intensive efforts to control the vector of dengue and yellow fever, the urban vector, I should say, which is Aedes aegypti.
That's a mosquito.
Yeah. Aedes aegypti is a very interesting mosquito, but it transmits both of these. It transmits yellow fever virus as well as all four serotypes of dengue virus. Now, dengue is, as I say, historically has been recognized from around the world, and it was pretty much under control here in the Western Hemisphere because of the efforts to eradicate Aedes aegypti. There was a big fear that yellow fever would get out of its maintenance cycle in the Amazon basin, for example, and get into the port cities again. So most of the countries of the Western Hemisphere did a very, very nice job on controlling Aedes aegypti. And if they didn't eradicate it, they at least knocked it down to very low populations. So its ability to transmit dengue wasn't very great. Well, as many times as this happens in public health, that was successful. And Aedes aegypti was pretty much under control. So if you're in a country with limited resources for public health, you obviously take them away. You put them somewhere else where there's another emerging need.
So your success is about to breed a failure.
Yeah. And what happened then is, with the decline of all these vector control programs throughout the Americas, dengue has come back with a real vengeance in this part of the world. Now, there are some very good reviews on this. Probably one of the better books in this regard is by Duane Gubler and a colleague. Duane is the director of the Centers for Disease Control Division of Infectious Borne Diseases in Fort Collins, Colorado. And for many years, he ran the dengue laboratory in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and he's compiled a really nice history of dengue and dengue hemorrhagic fever.
What kind of sick do you get when you get dengue?
Well, dengue is pretty much muscle aches, fever. It's not a mild disease. My friends who have had it say it can really incapacitate you, muscle aches and so forth. But what is scaring everybody is dengue hemorrhagic fever. And this is a very life-threatening disease with hemorrhage and shock and so forth. And perhaps a little history on this would be appropriate. This first emerged as a real clinical entity after World War II in Southeast Asia. And after the war, there was massive urbanization occurring. Aedes aegypti was moving into these cities and big cities in Southeast Asia, and we started having there was a different clinical picture of dengue infections. And a lot of this research was done by Sabin and people like that. They first described this. And what was happening, especially in children, was there were very, very severe infections. And indeed, dengue hemorrhagic fever and shock syndrome emerged as a leading cause of hospitalization and mortality in children in Southeast Asia. It's an interesting story because apparently what happened is, well, there are interesting stories, several interesting stories here. Dengue, there have been two major schools of thought as to why this clinical picture, this epidemiologic picture changed so dramatically.
If there are two, I'm going to interrupt you and we'll come right back to say what those two are. Please be with us when we return in just a moment with Dr. Barry Beatty, who is a professor of microbiology and also is the director of the Arthropod-Borne and Infectious Diseases Lab at Colorado State University. Be with us when we return in just a moment.